I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Fantastic. Well, welcome all of you to this wonderful evening, celebrating both an extraordinary life, of course, and an extraordinary book with an extraordinary panel. So things are at least three times extraordinary before anybody else has even spoken. I'm going to chuck that in at least a couple more times before I give the floor to anyone else. Welcome to the London Review Bookshop, of course, our very own House of Sky in many ways. Although it's walled, it has currently a ceiling. Of course, our imaginations can soar in here, just as J.A. Baker's soared in his extraordinary, there we are, encounter with the Peregrine, the life and work of which we're about to celebrate now. Of course, you know, this event and this book and of course, the shop itself take place in a larger world, well, a world which is challenged, of course, on many levels by our own actions in many different ways. Just today, seeing the news that plastics have found their way even to the bottom of the Pacific Trench, where we realise that our effect on the landscape and the ecology of the whole globe is now without parallel and without any kind of limit. So it's a delight, of course, tonight to celebrate a much gentler encounter with an extraordinary creature, a relationship between human and bird that suggests both an anger and a joy in its encounter, and a much richer and much more complex and much more enchanted vision of this relationship than the one I mentioned just now. But of course, this event also takes place in the city, and we've all made our way here by various means, of course, following various paths, ancient and modern. I came by tube from Stratford to Holborn, and on the way up the escalator at Holborn, of course, was greeted with an extraordinary litany of do's and do nots. Do walk on the left, do not walk on the right. Do hold the handrail, of course, do not run. But interestingly, as I reached the top of the escalator, the texture of the language deepened and, of course, a new complexity entered, because that older litany is now superseded by much more precise observation, not least, of course, in the spirit of J.A. Baker himself. He was a precise observer of his own environment, and clearly in the control room at Holborn, they are also precisely observing what's going on in their ecology. Because I was told just near the top, and of course this directly applied to me, how acutely observant they were, to hold the handrail while holding designer handbags. Obviously a particular threat of stumble and fall on the up escalator from the central line. But it's that kind of precise observation that in a much richer and more rewarding way we're going to obviously observe and celebrate tonight. You'll see the wonderful array of books laid out here, which pay testament to the creative team behind this particular book, while celebrating and tracking the life of an elusive individual, shall we say, at best, someone who, in Hetty Sanders' wonderful phrase, had all the makings of a successful ghost. That's not to say that this wasn't, of course, a hugely collaborative project, because it is and has been throughout. We should, of course, raise a huge glass, to Little Toller Books, of course, who have published this magnificent volume, yep. Little in name, giant in stature, of course. Adrian, Gracie and John here tonight. Amazing project enterprise brought together with the extraordinary collaborative team beyond, of course, the front of house here. Photographer Christopher Matthews, artist Joe Sweeting, and of course the Kickstarter funders, at least 20 of whom are in this very room tonight. More, of course, outside pressing to get in once the tickets were freed up by the first 20 who grabbed them. So many thanks to all the funders of this collective project, the collaborative makers, the publisher, and of course you, the wider audience as well. But the team we're celebrating tonight, and I'm going to hear from very, very shortly, are, of course, in front of you now. The great writer and advocate, Robert McFarlane, the author of this wonderful biography, Hetty Sanders, and the conservationist and archive creator, shall we say, John Fanshawe. They have all made this book possible. But, of course, Hetty Sanders has brought this life together with such sensitivity, intelligence and poise on the page that we're able to celebrate a book and not just a life outside of the covers, shall we say. So delighted to welcome now, first of all, John Fanshawe to set the archive base for us, how this book became even possible in the first place. John, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Gareth. So just a couple of words from me, really. I am in many ways a bit of an accidental archivist. All this grew out, really, of my being a birder in Cornwall as a boy, growing up in a place where peregrines had been, but had really pretty much disappeared from. So that's where it started with me. And this is the peregrine that I read, the version that I read, or at least not this very one, because I lost that one, but this is the version, which I must have been 14 or 15 when that happened. And it had a major impact on me. I think that looking now at where we are and what we're going to be celebrating and the amazing work that Hetty has done, I have to say that I never even really occurred to me to look at the bio that was on this book, which basically said so little about him. And so he was this mystery. But what I, of course, fell into was the extraordinary text. And I don't want to, I mean, just very briefly, a couple of things that I remember. Describing the differences in the English landscape as subtle and coloured by love. And I was a young birder, you know, this is a pretty unexpected text. In fact, when I first saw The Peregrine, I was expecting a very different book. And his wonderful acute observation, as one of my favourites of all time, is his description of wren under the wind, a wren in sun-like among fallen leaves and a dry ditch seems suddenly divine, like a small brown priest in a parish of dead leaves and wintry hedges devoted till death. And then last but not least, he's been criticised quite a lot for his observations of birds and whether or not they're genuine or not. But I love, there's one where he's quite close to when he talks about following the peregrine for 10 years. He describes a jay being killed by a peregrine. And after that, he says, gluttonous, hoarding jay. He should have hedgehopped and lurched from tree to tree in his usual furtive manner. He would never have bared the white flashes of his wings and rump to the watching sky. He was too vivid a mark. So I love that sense of the fact that Baker clearly had seen what thought about these birds a lot. So just to dive quickly into the archive, I mean, I was given a really extraordinary opportunity to edit his diaries. They'd been brought together initially by David Cobbin, the filmmaker. I did this with Mark Cocker. And it was out of that that this sense of being able to learn much more of Baker emerged, basically. The diaries, there are 667 pages, and we edited about a third of that into the book. But there are 500 place names, and it was in those place names, essentially, that we started to unravel Baker. Mark and I walking back and forth across that landscape. The extraordinary thing then was when we published the diaries, people started coming forwards, and we tracked back down to Baker's brother-in-law, Bernard Coe, who really was the linchpin in all of this. Extraordinarily humble guy, rather disconnected from the whole Baker story, which of course had quietened away. He very sweetly allowed me to visit, went and talked to him, and we concluded that it was just possible that in the house that Dorian Baker had lived, there might still be some material. So he went off, negotiated with her second husband, and returned, and I went back, and there were these extraordinary boxes. Just unbelievable. And I mean, I don't, you know the story, basically. But out of them came the binoculars, the photographs, the manuscripts, and all of this extraordinary material that, bewitchingly, Hetty has turned into the book and the illustrations. But just one other last point to say is that in the midst of all of that material was a couple of letters and material from Ted Dennis, who was Baker's best man. And he had then moved to the Welsh borders, and that was the last contact I had. We apparently had for him. But by dint of ringing up endless parish councillors and so on and so on and so on, eventually tracked him back to a new house in West Oxford. And it was there that I went, and really that was where all the letters came from, which I think was the key material. Oh, and it's critical material anyway for the biography. And so it was Ted Dennis and Don Samuel and John Thurmers, that group of tight-knit group of friends that Baker knew at school in Chelmsford, that had kept these letters. A wonderful little group of letters from Don Samuels, which he'd got out of his attic. He'd wrapped up in brown paper and written on the outside, "Confined to oblivion." Anyway, I'll probably stop there. I think that's enough from me. But more? No? Less?
Well,
more? I mean, I, the only thing I would say that is, I mean, I guess as a birder, you know, and a bird conservationist, Baker's a really interesting figure for me. I mean, he writes so powerfully and so movingly about the landscape. And I think, I mean, I've written a little bit before about this. There's an extraordinary article he wrote in Birds magazine about Foulness and about how angry he was about the potential development of the third airport there, which, of course, never went ahead. And I have this tremendous sense that if he'd been well and if he'd lived on, he would have become an extraordinarily activist. He would have written much more about the landscape of Essex that he loved. The other thing is that there's something extraordinary about handling the objects. I mean, Rob will probably talk about this as well, and maybe Hetty too, but the binoculars, particularly for a birder, it's amazing to pick up those birders. I mean, those binoculars. We're now so lucky to have these extraordinary modern optics. I mean, just unbelievable optics, but those old optics, many of them borrowed from the, you know, from, well, they were ex-Navy, those my first binoculars were ex-Army, I think. And so it was very special to handle those. And, well, as Rob did too, look through them and imagine that we were Baker. So that was very moving. And then these photographs are so wonderful. I mean, for me, there's one of him in, it's like a kind of spring. You have to pull it out. It's a school photograph. Do you remember that one, Hetty? From his primary school. And in the middle of it, there's this owlish figure, even then quite owlish. And there's a pencil line drawn right the way across the picture with an arrow pointing to him with the word "me," which is just lovely. And then there are a couple of really moving pictures, which for me as a, well, now eventually, it's not common for birders struggle to get married one way or another. But my long-suffering wife was taken on many, many bird ringing and birding trips, including to places like rubbish dumps to look at gulls. And things. But there's a fantastic couple of pictures of Baker and his wife on the edge of the estuary at the Blackwater, what it looks like. So you get the sense of poor Doreen being taken out into the birding landscape and photographed there, drawing their courtship, and probably wondering quite what she was marrying into. Anyway, I will shut up at that point.
John, that's tremendous. We'll definitely come back to you about that archive detection work, because in a way, tracking down the materials is a little bit equivalent to, of course, Baker himself tracking the birds in various ways, elusive in all sorts of different expressions. Hetty, John's idea of Baker marking himself "me" so clearly, it's almost like he doubted that he would recognise himself later in life in some way, that he would have disappeared. He was on this search to become partly nameless and almost invisible, so he had to sort of, you know, make the record then, perhaps, or at whatever point he did. This is a very elusive life, and although without this documentation, the book probably wouldn't have happened at all. It has happened, thankfully. But still, there's a lot of gaps in this life, aren't there? And you have to make the leaps of imagination at certain points. But just give us a sense of how you came to the archive and, of course, catalogued that and then took the book project.
Yeah. So I came to the archive mostly through... I was on a postgraduate course with being taught by Rob. I wasn't actually going to take the course. And then I thought, oh, God, why not? sorry, Rob. One week we had to read this book, and it was, I read it and I thought, gosh, it was so startlingly strange and wasn't at all what I thought it was going to be. Had this very, like, violent, cold beauty to it. So that when I actually ended up writing about it on the during the course, and Rob said to me, oh, why don't you go and look at, there's this box of stuff that was Baker's at the University of Essex, why don't you go and look at it? And I went over and spent an afternoon rifling through it. Anyway, did all that stuff. And finally, it was kind of funny, during the time that I was writing about this, I'd known that there were peregrines in Cambridge, but I'd never, ever seen one. And suddenly, all I could see everywhere were peregrines, everywhere, every day. And I kept walking into like the university library and having these bits of bloody feathers just like falling down in front of me, all of which I took photos of and sent to Rob, which I thought was quite weird. peregrines. I kept seeing them everywhere. And when I finished that, I was cycling down Silver Street in Cambridge and I heard this god-awful racket. And I thought, what on earth is that? And I looked up and there was the fledgling bird of the peregrine nest sort of flying down Silver Street above me. And I thought, oh God, these things again. and I thought, well, I'm not sure what I'm going to do now, so I might as well go and see if they want the archive cataloguing. I kind of put the idea in my head. I thought, well, I enjoyed that, and I thought Baker was pretty amazing. I got to the archive and was cataloguing it, and I cataloged it kind of, I guess, fairly perfunctorily in that I was going through the materials and just trying to turn them into a list of things, and I didn't read lots of the stuff all the way through, particularly the letters, because some of the letters are incredibly long. As John said, they are really what gives the idea of Baker as a person. And then I came back to the archive when Rob had come up with the idea of the, Rob and John had sort of come up with the idea of the biography, and I'd sort of been thinking about it. And I sat down and I thought, oh, I better read some of the letters just to sort of get an idea of, because everything else, you could feel Baker through them, like the maps that he'd drawn on and the binoculars and the optics, but it was quite hard to get a sense of the person. And I sat down and the first letter I opened, I started reading it, and it was from when he was working in the British Museum Library as an assistant librarian, which was a job that he hated. And he was only there for about a month because he got sacked for taking books home when he shouldn't, for borrowing them. And I read this paragraph, and so it's March of 1946. Baker wrote to his friend Donald Samuel about the job. And he said, "The people who use the reading room are indeed a peculiar crowd. The idea, of course, is that if you look through 50 books by others, you can get enough material to write one of your own. This is called research and enables you to abandon such unnecessary niceties as please and thank you, to forget where you are and to wear clothes that don't fit." I felt quite bad and made sure to say please and thank you very loudly to the librarians at the reading room in Essex. And I thought, oh, wow, this is a real person. And a very human person, and a very humorous person. And really from there, reading through the letters and all those things, I really kind of developed himself. And there are these points, like you say, with the photograph, where he had, and I sort of sat in the reading room after reading that paragraph thinking, oh Christ, that's me. It's sort of, there's a sort of feeling of Baker's ghost, kind of looking forward into the future, which is very strange. But he did sort of know that he was, I think he was a nice person, but he wasn't a very easy person, quite a difficult man, and not always very nice. Lots of his humour is sort of a little bit jibing. But he did admit to his friend Donald Samuel, "I am a self-centered person in the extreme. My temperament dictates such egotism." That was the sort of character that he recognized in himself, even as a very young man. He knew that he was a sort of introspective, sort of prone to bouts of sort of very personal malaise. But he was, in that sense, very much a writer, in the way that he thought of himself as a writer. And I don't know, Robert Mitchell has written, he said something like, writers are egotistical little tyrants who can't work with other people. I hope this book shows that we can work with a particular colour. Yeah, I think there was an element of that with about him. He found it difficult to work with others, and was very private and driven, very driven.
Thank you. We'll come back to his earlier life a little later on, because it seems very important to give a sort of flavour of that. It informs, obviously, what follows. But could you just give us a short reading, perhaps? From the book, wherever you would like to go in.
Should I do one at the end as well?
Absolutely, that'd be great. Okay, so the more the merrier. Yeah.
Well, I'll read the first, one of the early encounters with a peregrine, Baker's great. Peregrine, that he had. Thank you. And then I'll finish later with the last sort of diary entry that we have of his. On a Friday outing in October 1954. When Baker saw some a bit right about some grey plover beforehand, Baker also thought he saw something else more exciting. At the bottom of that day's diary entry, he wrote, "It may have been on this day, or possibly on a September day, that I saw a bird that I spoke to myself about as a peregrine. I was at the angle of Lauriston Marsh, between Joyce's Bay and Lauriston Beach, when a pigeon-like bird flew over, high and fast, going west-southwest, into wind. I thought at that time that I couldn't see a peregrine in such a locality, being ignorant of their movements. Something unfamiliar about the fast, flapping flight made me try to get a better view. I failed to do so." That was quite typical of his early birding. He wasn't very successful. That was one of his first encounters with a peregrine. I'll leave the rest to Rob.
Thank you very much. Rob, you've written extensively about the book over recent years, and clearly it's had an enormous influence on you. There's a wonderful moment early in Hetty's biography where she talks about a meeting with you in Cambridge and then stepping out into a kind of synchronous kill that confirms the project is on the right track, shall we say. I'm reminded of that great observation by J.G. Ballard, I think in the Atrocity exhibition, which perhaps is quite suitable, where he says, deep assignments run through all our lives. There are no coincidences. And it seems that that's absolutely the case in Hetty's encounter with Baker, but perhaps also with yours. The book's had a huge influence on you. Mm-hmm. Give us a little sense, if you could, of when that started and how it's developed.
Hello, everybody. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Gareth. Thanks to everyone here, and just like to take this public opportunity to congratulate Hetty, who it is, for anyone to have written this book would be an extraordinary achievement, and for someone to write this as their first book at, am I allowed to call you young? at a younger age is absolutely formidable, and she's done an extraordinary job, not least as she first met the peregrine 2.5 years ago. Then I thought I'd just begin with a story of misidentification, which seems to me in keeping with... No, don't worry, not seems to me in keeping with Baker's own bird watching, but bears slightly on my own second chief encounter with the book. I first read it at the age that John was when he first met it, and it gripped me very tightly then. I didn't know that it would never let me go, as it were. But in 2002... the New York Review of Books got in touch, or 2003, I think, and asked me if I would introduce a new edition of The Peregrine, which by that point I think had fallen out of print. Yeah. And there was clearly a latent cult fascination with this book and its powers, but it was pretty latent. And I said that I would be thrilled to do so, and not least because I rather cherished the NYRB editions, and it was very exciting to me that this would occur. So I wrote the introduction, which made all sorts of factual errors about Baker because nobody knew who he was at that point, and I incorrectly surmised this and that, and my research was nowhere near as good as Hetty's has been. But nevertheless, the edition was published, and it arrived in a big box. And I happened to be, I think I'm recording this right, with Helen MacDonald at the time the edition arrived. We were spending a lot of time together around then. And I unpacked it. It's here. I unpacked it, brought it out, and there was a sharp intake of breath from Helen. And even I knew that the bird that was on the front of this edition of The Peregrine was not a peregrine. Helen said, "That's a fucking red-tailed hawk, or words to this effect. And we kind of sat there, and the bathos of this moment was very powerful. And it was only afterwards that I began in my lectures on the peregrine writing about it, that, saying that this was, you know, the equivalent to Tarka being fronted with a polecat or Moby Dick with a dolphin. And it really was pretty substantial in a book called The Peregrine. So anyway, we made this clear to Edwin at the New York Review of Books, and that edition was fairly swiftly taken out of circulation, and possibly at this point still covers the M25 somewhere near South Mimms. But and they came back with an ornithologically accurate edition, which some of you may have seen. Baker's influence on me has been huge, and the best figure I have for it really is that of optics, and it's something we've talked about a great deal. John and I have, and I'm sure Hetty has done the same, have held Baker's binoculars up to our eyes, and when you do so, there is at once a kind of primary thrill of the experience, and there is a secondary guilt at the excessive symbolism of the act as well. But Baker's style is so forceful that it comes to lensatically determine perception. That's been my experience. To the degree that I see in Baker's words, and I've tried to write about this, that when you see, as I have done on the shores of Loch Erech, when you see a peregrine circling, the words of perception that leap to your mind and to your lips are those of Baker, and you realize that you truly are seeing through style as a kind of lens, and that's both surprising and slightly intimidating. And I think those of us who've been very powerfully affected by Baker's style, those of us who are writers, have found it quite difficult to get away from it when writing about, certainly, raptors, landscape more broadly. Although he says very chasteningly on the first page of the Peregrine, detailed descriptions of a landscape are tedious, which I feel I possibly ought to pin up on my writing desk rather more visibly than I have to this date. But he's, in fact, I think optics in a sort of analog sense slightly fall short of what Baker does. And I've come to think of it a little bit more as a kind of Oculus Rift, as a sort of augmented reality visor that is slipped down over you, because he isn't just a visual writer, although that's what's drawn people like Werner Herzog to him. Some of you will know that The Peregrine is one of the three books on Herzog's rogue film school reading list, the others being magnificently Virgil's... is it the Aeneid? There's the Aeneid, and there's the Warren Report, and there's the Peregrine. And, well, that's fantastic. But he is a fabulously multisensory writer. It's landscape on acid. It's something that happens where your whole sensorium is adjusted by what you have read, and it's really hard to get away from. Once you've dropped the tab, it's in your bloodstream. So I think this power is fascinating, and actually one of the things that Hetty's done, and what the archive that John really magnificently has sleuthed together, is reveal to us some of the technicalities and the craft of how Baker made this style that explodes into the reader's mind. And I don't know if what your sense is of what the archive reveals, Hetty, about that style.
Well, I think you're completely right. It has that when he says that landscapes are tedious to write about in detail. He then goes on to write a whole book about landscape. I mean, but he writes it in such a specific way, where it's the focus of the landscape is not on the things that we would normally see. It's on the things that the bird itself would see. It's very much. It doesn't include, only includes humans as these sort of menacing shadows at the sort of edge of vision, and the very bright and startling things are the other creatures of the landscape, the other birds, the prey animals, the moments of the kill, and the vision, these sort of long horizons that you get, sort of visions of the Blackwater Estuary. I think that's something in his. But he did these. I think the archive shows that he one of the ways in which he achieved this was to have many, many maps. He loved his Ordnance Survey maps and all sorts of, and he had these incredible collections of maps of various areas around Chelmsford and the Blackwater Estuary, all of which he would mark up in various ways with his either the tracks that he would follow or various distances. Danbury Hill, which I think John talks about and I talk about at the beginning of the book, or the biography, and which Baker starts his own Peregrine book with, the long submarine-shaped hill he talks about.
Yeah.
Danbury Hill is the sort of weird centre for it. And on one of the maps, I think it's even the one on the end papers, yeah, it is. He went round all of the contours and outlined them in red pen, just to get the very stark vision of what it is that a peregrine, particularly, but any bird would have seen from the sky. And he was fascinated by his incredible collection of books, which we were lucky enough. John was lucky enough to get photographs of some of his library shelves, this sort of personal reading. And he was fascinated by all sorts of geology and landscape texts, but also he had a collection of pilot guides, and he must have had a very detailed knowledge of the. I'm not sure whether he sailed. I'm pretty certain he didn't sail or anything himself, but he certainly had a very detailed eye for the shape of the land as it met the sea, in a way that one would get from the estuary side. And the sort of the way the land sort of the shoreline along there is so fluid. He had a very excellent eye for that. He's a sort of focus on shifting waters and rising land, I think, that came from those maps and that sort of detailed knowledge of the estuary and the area that he was living in.
Thank you. I'm very struck by what you're saying about him marking the maps, the document, the writing, the kind of the mark making on the page is a form of sort of perceptual encounter before or after the event. He's trying to reverse the kind of the point of view, of course, to be the thing looked at in more conventional encounters. I mean, John, where does he sit in terms of his bird watching, bird being kind of register? I mean, of course, he's way out at one end of the spectrum. But I was struck in The Guardian last weekend, Jonathan Franzen wrote about his time in Ghana, bird watching, and he called himself a very failed bird watcher. He called himself a lister, not a twitcher. And that he was obsessed with listing his encounters in a kind of classifying way, which, of course, J.A. Baker also did in various ways. But what range of opportunities are there to be a bird watcher? This is not a world that I know at all well. But, obviously between full sort of inhabitation of the bird that one's watching, but various other encounters along the way towards that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's funny you should mention Franzen, because he, quite apart from the fact that he seemed to be searching for the melancholy woodpecker, which was a rather wonderful bird.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
He kind of admitted himself to be a lister, a twitcher, a gatherer of lists, which I guess many of us are. I mean, I have a notebook in my pocket with a list of birds that I saw yesterday, and one does do that very much. One of the striking things about Baker, I think, was that when I first encountered the diaries, they were very un-birder-like. So, he would go home in the evening and write them up. But then when we began to get the archive material, lists did appear, lists of birds. So he was obviously had that listing scrupulously, but also, interestingly, analysed his texts in lists, didn't he? He was very analytical about his own texts of similes and metaphors and adjectives, everything measured out and thought through. So he was a strange mix. I mean, I'm interested... I mean, many of you in the audience are probably birders and bird watchers, but birds catch people in a whole variety of different ways. Tim Dee writes very movingly about this, I think. And I had an interesting conversation once with the artist Marcus Coates, conceptual artist Marcus Coates, who is a fantastic interpreter, shaman of birds, basically. And Marcus said that, I grew up and became a conceptual artist, but I was caught as a boy by birding in the same way in the conversation with me as I was. I just went off and did a doctorate in tropical forest birds. So I had a very different trajectory. But I think that extraordinary capture that birds have over people is quite common. Hugh Miles, the filmmaker, actually wrote, when I talked to him about The Peregrine, he said he read Baker and it helped him become a better filmmaker. Mm. It allowed him to see in ways he felt he might not have seen without reading the book. So he was kind of Baker as a school teacher for filmmaking.
Well, Herzog admits that. I wrote to Herzog a year ago now because I'd been waiting, as so many people have been waiting, for Herzog to film The Peregrine. I mean, it couldn't be a more Herzogian subject. It's one man and his wilderness. It constrained, in this case, by the perimeters that Baker so forcefully imposed on his subject. And I wrote to Herzog and I said, look, I sent him the photographs of the eviscerated white dove that Hetty and I had discovered stepping out from the meeting we'd had about her biography. And there, below the belfry of the church over the road, was the eviscerated white dove. Oh, here we are in Baker's symbolic world again, but perfectly splayed on the pavement. So I took a photograph of that, sent it to Herzog, and I said, when are you going to film it? Yeah, please film it. And if you do, could I possibly just, you know, get involved a little bit? And to my astonishment, he wrote back the next day. He's actually, I now know he's quite rapid response. And he wrote back and he said some very nice things about things I'd said about The Peregrine, which he knew. He unfortunately had the Red-Tailed Hawk edition, but we'll let that pass. And then he said, but there are some books which are unfilmable. He said there's one by Buchner, and there is Baker's The Peregrine. Indeed, I would go so far as to say that anyone who tries to film this book should be shot without trial. So, yours, Werner. Okay, message received. But I just wanted to pick up very quickly on something John said, which I think is fascinating, and it's actually something Hetty, in her own graduate work on this book, helped me to see much more clearly than I had before. Baker was a list maker, a fierce observer of his own prose. And one of the amazing things in the archive is that if you get to see the proof copies, these red-jacketed proof copies of both The Hill of Summer, which I think is a problematic text, which is effectively sustained ekphrasis of a wood, and The Peregrine, which is much more dynamic in all the ways we know it to be, what you find happens is that he goes through his own paragraphs and he subjects them to a form of imagist accountancy. He tots up every metaphor, every simile, so he distinguishes between S and M, doesn't he? Because I think he sees the metaphor as implicitly more dynamic than the simile. Every verb, and at the bottom of pages, there are running tallies for number of metaphors, number of verbs, number of similes.
Sometimes pronouns, too.
Sometimes pronouns. Does he do this for adjectives and adverbs? I'm not sure he does.
Sometimes adjectives.
And if you look at his maps, he's doing this for raptors. He's putting shorthand annotations in for where he's seen them. But what he's trying to do in that prose, speaking from a craft point of view and a technical point of view, is to absolutely maximize the kinesis of that prose. He wants more verbs and metaphors, which are drastically displacing tropes, embedded in that prose as he can get, because The Peregrine is the most dynamic presence. It's the presence that sets the landscape moving around it. And I think when you see him drilling down into his own effects, it's absolutely fascinating. You realize he was highly self-conscious about what he was doing and the effect he was achieving. Of course, when we meet it innocently, and that's why it almost stuns us on first encounter.
Yeah. I think sorry.
In the police course.
I think in that sense, He was a birder, but he was a sort of literary birder first. Mm-hmm. He was a writer before he was a birder, most definitely. And it's funny, he says in the introduction to The Peregrine, I came late to the love of birds, but I don't think that's strictly true I think it was in terms of his ability, in terms of coming late to the life of a birder. I think he didn't reach that until later in his life. But his love of birds, you find in his letters early on to his school friends. He's sort of always evoking the landscape and the bird life within it. And some of his favourite poems and the quotes that he insists, he wrote out an entire Newbolt poem about the nightjar, whose loveliness is far deeper than the optic nerve, which is such a Baker. That was when he was, I think, 19, and that line is such a Baker line, you know, that you can imagine him writing that. Mm. And the sense of the sort of optic nerve is what stimulates so much in his own work. I think he must have absorbed so much of a literary landscape of writing about birds, which he then migrated into his own external love and external experiences.
Thank you. I mean, given that you've talked about his literary sort of origin, should we say? Mm. I mean, it wasn't a given in physical or health terms that he was ever going to be doing what he was doing. Was he was extremely challenged in all sorts of ways, emotionally and health-wise, in the early part of his life. I'd like to ask you more about that, but I'm struck also by the poetry that is reproduced here in this extraordinary volume. There we are. And this poem, The Lost Kingdom, which is exactly what you're... really stands out as a key text. In my careless childhood, I was a wanderer, he starts. And at the end, he says, now all this is changed. Across the green fields lie long rows of the sharp red roofs. They have built over my childhood dreams. There is no way back to the bright fields of my youth, which can't help but prompt me to think about Alain Fournier's book, Le Grand Monde, The Lost Domain, which it's almost an English counterpart to, it seems. Mm. This idea of trying to recover a landscape that's impossible to recover. But how important is his childhood in leading him towards writing? I mean, not just in terms of the kind of ideas, you know, that lead him to the Peregrine, but his actual biographical event, if you like, in terms of the fact of him becoming a writer at all.
Should I answer?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's very important. His childhood growing up in Chelmsford, his only child, the child of a quite unhappy marriage. He was a very...
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Seems to have been a very sensitive child as well, and suffered quite a lot from a quite aggressive father who also had a number of possible mental health issues. He may well have had a lobotomy at some point, which I talk about in the book. So I think in himself, I think that perhaps taught him in many ways to be very private and to hold lots of his emotions in. And his own childhood, you know, he was a child of the suburbs, essentially, in Chelmsford. His father worked at one of the factories as a draftsman, Baker spent a lot of time as a child. The landscape around Chelmsford at the time that he was experiencing was under such radical shift, such enormous change. I think there was in those in sort of between 1929 and 1940, 49, something like a quarter of what was termed permanent grassland in England was ploughed up and changed and built upon, and Chelmsford was vastly expanding. You had the impact of the Second World War. He himself experienced a lot of... Chelmsford was very terribly blitzed in the Second World War as well, and many of the streets around where Baker was living and his parents were living were bombed. I think that must have had a very, very drastic effect on on someone who was a very sensitive individual. And he sort of had... He spent a lot of time outside and travelling around, you know, cycling around the lanes in Chelmsford and the sort of estuary area, which did impact him a great deal. And I think, actually, as a child, he was always a bit of a loner. I mean, his John managed to get hold of some of his friends from primary school and early secondary school, and they very much labelled him. They sort of said, well, he was a bit of a loner. He seemed to have, I say, suffered, but then it did him perhaps favors in that he managed to be able, he was able to write this book. But I think he was definitely suffered from a feeling of being an outsider, which had developed itself even from a very small child. Like he wrote in some notes around the age of 14, he felt what he called an unaccountable fear of deprivation. There was, he said, a sense of freedom lost, a feeling of absence that he connected strongly to a longing to be outdoors. Since his childhood, he experienced what he felt a growing sense of being imprisoned, of being bound like a bird that has the power of flight. Such a longing was in his mind raised to a freedom that belonged to nature and the things beyond the human. His jotted notes ramble through a series of impressions from this time. What he wanted, he said, was, quote, to get away, to be hidden, free because unknown, nameless as an animal is nameless and unknown. There was the realization again that there was another life, a life beyond, out there, where all that could ever really matter was happening unregarded. And, you know, he was a teenager at this point and very young, and he then became quite... He suffered with bouts of illness at the time as well from... the sort of early onset of ankylosing spondylitis, this arthritic condition that he had as an adult. And I think his sense of being always on the outside of the sort of groups in general, he was very intelligent but not very good at school, or intelligent but didn't like bits of school and didn't do well enough to continue into what he really wanted, which he really wanted to be a great writer even from a sort of teenage time. And I think he sort of felt... That school hadn't really been for him, but then he felt simultaneously like he'd sort of been cast out in a way. He didn't have a connection to lots of the things that he felt would make him a great writer, which he thought of as being a university education or the right qualifications and that sort of thing. So I think he always felt on the outside of all of these things. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. No, tremendous. And I think from that time, of course, is where you take the phrase for the title, because he talks about this work that he will make, doesn't he, which will be his House of Sky, long before, you know, he finally kind of pins himself down.
That was when he was about 21, 22? Yeah, 2021. Yeah, when he was working at the... again, he went through a series of... brief jobs all in a row, most of which he didn't find to his liking. One of which was at the Oxford University Press, the building which is in near St Paul's. And he was sitting on top of the roof of. He used to just go and sit on the roof and watch the birds and the people and the cars and all this sort of thing. I think, again, was typical of him. Sort of, he felt very much distanced from the people around him, and sort of was always on the edge of everything. And I think he sort of found solace in sort of extracting himself and sitting on the roof and watching all the things and sort of writing about it. And yeah, that was where he came up with the title with the idea of what he called My House of Sky, which would be whatever novel he was going to write in the future. Which, of course, was what it became. But
Fantastic, thank you. Well, of course, this is a loved book, and it would not be the book of the stature it is without its audience, of which you are now the important representative this evening. 50 years since it was published, 15 years since it was reissued by New York Review Books, 30 years, of course, since J.A. Baker died, in December 1987, aged only 61. So a series of dates there to navigate as the book both hits its prize-giving status at the beginning and then disappears, slightly returns, and is now, of course, sans-pareil, as they say in France. A country we're soon to leave, of course. It would be difficult for us to go back and even say those words in this country after the end of March 2019. So we'll enjoy the Frenchness. Please feel free to speak in any language you wish in celebrating this masterwork here and the wonderful biography that has come from it. We're going to go to the audience now. So please do share your thoughts about J.A. Baker, about the Peregrine, of course, about the Hill of Summer as well, and the diaries, John, Rob, and Hetty's wonderful work. Now is your time. Seize it, as they say, in other languages, also from other countries. Carpe. Yes, let's do that. Yeah, thank you.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about when you're talking about his kind of spondylitis and his rheumatism. I know Rob's written a little bit about this before. Oh, sorry. I know Rob's written a little about this, about his hands sort of becoming claws and him kind of going from being an observer of the Peregrine and the landscape to being sort of part of it, or being, you know, transforming into the thing that he kind of revered or admired. I just wondered if that, did that come through across in his letters, in his diaries, or was that something that's more this from the sense of the book? Or
thank you.
Yeah, well, I'll say something and then Hetty can answer. So somebody wrote an essay just yesterday, actually, I think, which slightly taking me to task for using the word lessened. I think I said that Baker was lessened by his illness, his spondylitis, and I think that's right to pick me up on that word. So he was certainly changed by it, and just as he was changed by his myopia, I mean, he had some curtailed optics of his own. And I think certainly I find it hard to read the book not in light of the fact that this was a man who was unable to move as freely as he wished, whose body was literally fusing itself towards stasis, and who couldn't see with anything like the extraordinary precisions of the Peregrine's eyeball, which is a miracle of optical engineering that it is. So it's something that has fascinated me. Those people who've seen his author photograph will know, fascinatingly to me, that he presents very confrontingly, once you've seen it, that the hand that has already begun to be fused is front most in the author photograph, when he does have an author photograph, and it's almost become a single white paddle because the joints are fusing. So Baker, it's impossible to know why he did that, but what is clear is that he chose to place that frontmost rather than to hide it, which would have been very easy to do in a Head and Shoulders author's shot. So that I will leave it there with my kind of apology for the verb lessened, but certainly a commitment to the sense that he was changed in ways that influenced the book, and then this fascinating moment of his presentation of that illness. I don't know what Hetty would then say.
I can agree with that. It was I think I'd probably add that he was extremely private about it, which is interesting. He is a person seemingly of many contradictions at every turn. So on the one hand, he was extremely private about his illness, and many of the people who worked with him, he worked at the AA as a manager for a while in Chelmsford, and would have been his disease. It was sort of had flare ups. It wasn't a sort of constant thing necessarily, although it would have affected him, and it got worse as he grew older, obviously, and you can see that in the writing. It gets more spiky and more crabbed and much more tortured, I guess, in that sense, pained. But he was very private about it, and many people who knew him and who worked with him had no idea that he suffered from anything like it. And in that sense, I think he did turn inwards with it in some ways, and I don't know how.
Is there any explanation in the archive as to why he holds that hand up in the photograph?
No, nothing, because that's actually I think the latest photograph that there is of him, and there aren't any. There's certainly none from any later date. Whether or not there were any, or he didn't want any, isn't really clear. But certainly, it was something that he didn't necessarily share. But then, saying that, when people were writing to him in the 70s, in the years after his books were published, he had many fan letters saying,
show me peregrines.
Yeah, saying, bring me peregrines. He got lots of fan mail saying, oh, thank you very much, I appreciate, less appreciation, really. And asking him various things. And he did write back to a number of them, and in a number of them, that from the replies that were sent, it's clear that he did talk about his illness to these, essentially, strangers. So it's, again, he can't have been... It's funny, like, that he mentions it to some people, but not to others. I don't know, but he obviously affected him a great deal, because it restricted him so much in his later life. That after writing The Peregrine and The Hill of Summer, he really desperately wanted to go and write more, but he was stopped from doing so by his illness. Like, he basically couldn't get out. And without that immediate, although he had these wonderful diaries, reams and reams and reams of material to work from, he really needed the immediate encounter and the sort of the need to be outside among these things really was what he wanted, but he couldn't get it, and that really stifled him afterwards, I think.
Thank you very much. Yes, please, come here, and then we'll come to you. Thank you. Absolutely, yeah. We should say this is being recorded, of course, for London Review Bookshop circulation. I hope that's all right with everyone. Thank you very much.
It's a question for Hetty. I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, but I came to The Peregrine quite recently, and I was on a train journey from Bristol to York. It was very hot, cramped and sweaty, and I was reading the book, and it had a very an immense impact on me, especially the focus on death. I began to think, if another bird gets its head ripped off, I'm going to have to get off the train at Sheffield. But I just wondered, he seems to have a kind of almost pathological vision of the world. It's not simply about this marvellous bird, but also there's so much death in the book. And I just wondered what you felt about that.
Thank you. Yes, it there are some quite gruesome points in it. I think, I don't know, right at the start he says, I will make plain the business of, the bloodiness of killing, is what he says. I will make plain the bloodiness of killing. And he's talking in terms of the birds, but he's also, I think, talking about the sort of general context. So much of his motivation, what came from... a landscape that was being poisoned, basically, particularly in East Anglia, particularly in Essex, the impacts of organochlorine pesticides like dieldrin, particularly, and aldrin, were terrifyingly immense. There were you would go on walks in the countryside and find hundreds of bodies of birds just littering the woodlands and the fields, because of the impact, because of the poisonous effects of the pesticides that were being sprayed on the crops. So I think in that sense, the book itself is, and also he's writing it from although it's not dated the year, lots of the experiences that he's drawing on for the sort of the year that he writes about, which is really a sort of conglomeration of all of his 10, 12 years of diaries. It's 1950, what was the year of the Great Freeze? The Great
62 to 63.
Yes. So that terrible winter, where so many creatures in the woodlands and the countryside were dying of exposure.
And that's when he meets that's the famous scene where he meets the heron, frozen, half frozen into the stubble, and he gives it peace. And then he famously says, "We are the killers. We stink of death."
Mm. Yeah.
And I think I would just perhaps add that to me, at least, this emphasis on death and human complicity on death is actually one of the reasons it grips us half a century on. Mm. It feels that this has come only truer. Many of us here are talking about the Anthropocene, this enhanced sense of feedback loops between our action, this widely distributed, unevenly distributed sense of complicity and guilt with the sixth great extinction crisis. And so I think something about its fierceness, the confrontation it has with guilt, the species shame that is suffered and denounced, the wish to, in fact, flee your species and become the guiltless killer, which is what a peregrine is, is hard at work in all of this. And I think we, many of us who read it now, and I'm still dimly finding my way into the bloody psychodrama of its innards, as it were, feel some version of that. And that's why it's both confronting and, in its very odd way, hopeful. So, anyway.
Yeah, there's something almost cathartic in it, but something that is very troubling. It definitely has that effect of it's the bloodiness of complicity as well as the he wasn't going to shy away from the clear sort of observational nature of nature, which is pretty nasty in itself. But he also wasn't going to shy away from the death that was being perpetrated complicitly, but also unthinkingly by people upon animals, basically.
Thank you very much. A question here. And we should say, of course, that despite our questioners' unease on that train and possible early departure from the journey, there are many positive reasons to get off at Sheffield. We just need to make that clear. I mean, this is a London-focused bookshop with a national reach, of course. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yes, please.
Hi. Given that he's a writer who's influenced writers, were there writers who influenced him? Were there books that you know that he loved or was fascinated by or interested by?
Well, yes. I mean, I think one of the most extraordinary things that emerged, and I have to say this is Bernard Coe, his brother-in-law again, was this amazing photographs of his library, which were literally... Yeah. Taken spine by spine, and I did an analysis of the library, and there are many books in there. I mean, I'm very struck, obviously, by the poets, and particularly Hughes. He had a real interest in that, and you can, going back to this theme of red and tooth and claw, I think that sense, quite a lot of people have written that he was even more so than Hughes.
Ballard,
yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. I would say, I think just going back to the discussion about the time at which he was writing a little bit, he's very much a child of, what was then the Silent Spring.
Yeah.
The
absolutely.
Beginning of the environment movement. Yeah. I think, Hetty's describing the impact of those chemicals on birds. I mean, this is what Carson was writing about in the US as well. Mm. I don't think we can imagine what it was like to be in that landscape now when so many birds were dying. Mm-hmm. Conor Jameson has even argued that there were so many birds were dead in the landscape that perhaps Baker confused some of these dead birds with kills and vice versa. So, it was a very different sort of encounter.
John, could you just say a word about, because he was also a child of the, as it were, of the nuclear age. I mean, it's fascinating that there are two kinds of dust that settle from the air in this book, and two kinds of death that fall from the air, and one is pesticidal and the other is radioactive. And John particularly has been really fascinated on Bradwell Power Station and what was happening. So Bradwell Power Station, as some people know, is perched out on the end of one of the Essex peninsulas and the peregrines have nested there.
They've nested there, and they, of course, were being, the power station was being built whilst Baker was still alive.
Yeah.
So that landscape where if you walked along the north side of the Blackwater Estuary, you look out over this fantastic landscape, and into the midst of this was growing this great big square nuclear reactor, this block. which ironically, when it was decommissioned, was held up for a while because peregrines came and nested on it. although, regrettably, I suspect that some of the nest was destroyed.
But yes,
I mean, I think it's really important to think of him in that 1960s period. And the war had a huge impact on him as well. Sorry.
Yeah. We'll just take the last question here.
Sorry.
Well, it's just information.
Oh, information? Always good. Always good. Yeah, thank you.
I have here, as well as the loss of, or the damage caused by chemicals, the loss of habitat also affected birds. Between 46 and 70, 4,500 miles of hedgerow were grubbed up annually in England and Wales, with the greatest losses sustained in the eastern counties.
Yeah, he wrote about it in his diaries as well.
Thank you. Yes, could we take the... More? This is other... it's all happening now, isn't it? Right, we absolutely can keep going. Thank you. We'll just take this one first, and then we'll maybe gather the three and see how they sit together, and then scatter them again if they don't. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Just to salute your phenomenal achievement in producing this book in 2.5 years or
however
long. I mean, it's just amazing. So, congratulations.
With help.
It seems you've spoken about three different lives. This baker's work life, his going out, his life in the natural world, and his life as an artist. Is there anything in the archive about his relationship, his domestic life, and his relationship with Doreen?
Thank you.
The short answer is not really, but little bits do pop up. It's interesting. The diaries that he wrote covered 1954 to 1965-ish, 66. And in all of that time, all of his diaries are specifically bird-related and to do with his walks and his sort of birding expeditions. There are little points, though, where Doreen like, emerges through the sort of... Textual, but yeah, through the hedgerows of the, and some of these things are really hard to read. He just crams all this stuff in, like tiny, writes over himself as well. She appears occasionally. Things like he couldn't particularly later on after he published The Peregrine. Baker was never able to drive. He never got a license to drive, and Doreen could drive. And later in the 70s, she would drive him to places, and he would note things like Doreen dropped me off here. And that sort of thing, and during his sort of earlier birding, he would be noting things that Doreen had seen. So he'd be writing down, Dee saw this at the reservoir, or brought back some feathers for Dee. So he'd keep going collect and primroses and flowers and feathers and things. He'd sort of bring back. Or he talked about their garden and the birds that he'd seen in the garden that day. But she doesn't really appear at all. I found it very difficult to find out that much about her.
She has a brief entry in the archive. She leaves a document, doesn't she, with David Cobham?
Yeah.
Where she actually talks a little bit about him. So there's a very brief glimpse of what she... And she doesn't she say he could be a prickly customer?
Yeah, exactly what she says.
There's a slightly long-suffering... partner's moment there, but there's also I think it's an odd kind of list. It sort of runs through the chronology, doesn't it, confirming certain details.
Yeah.
There's clearly a tenderness there as well as a exhaustion.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Let's hear the last three questions, and then we'll see how their ordering lies. Thank you. Comments, questions. Thank you.
Very quickly. Is the Peregrine more about the Peregrine, or is it more about J.A.B. Baker, his times, and us all sitting in the LRB bookshop now? And the reason why I ask it is there's two approaches. One is trying to be inside the thing in itself, i.e. the Peregrine, or just relativizing it and using metaphor and simile to sort of... Mm.
Thank you. Okay. We'll hold that important thought, and we'll just take... Was there another one? Thank you.
I was struck by the comment that he was a literary person before he was a bird person.
Uh-huh.
And did he see himself as, in the history of sort of landscape nature writing in Britain, did he see himself as having some position there, where he was just kind of super generous.
Yeah.
Tremendous.
Decided to write a book about birds.
Thank you very much. We'll hold that as well, and just take the final comment here, and then we'll spin it into an extraordinary weave of creative responses.
We might have four.
Thank you. Yeah.
I just wanted to comment and one sort of slightly off-piste question. My father, who was conservationist in the 60s, so was very involved in, has always been a birder and still is. He always said the one thing that people didn't say about the Peregrine was that it was a campaigning book.
Mm.
He remembered reading the book when it came out.
Absolutely.
And he always says that it was never recognised for being a campaigning book. And he always actually thought that Baker didn't have the confidence to be a campaigner because he felt that he was looked down on. I don't know. I find that quite interesting. Mm. That. Mm. And just slightly a different thing, because as Rob said, Peregrine almost disappeared from sight, that, you know, sort of fell below the line. Do you think there are other books that could be brought back that have fallen below the line? I suppose I'm particularly thinking of The Red Start.
Thank you very, very much. So we've got
maybe there's a hint there for some.
maybe there's a hint there. So we've got the idea of the book being about Peregrine or about Baker. We have the literary antecedents and also the influence going forwards, I would add. Yeah. And then those books that are lost, waiting to be recovered, but also that crucial observation about the campaigning. John, I'd like to ask you about the campaigning aspect of the book. I'd like to ask Hetty, obviously, about the book being about Baker or about the Peregrine, and Rob, you about the literary placing, backwards and forwards, if I could. And perhaps we could start with you, John, in terms of its campaigning quality.
Well, it's a really interesting point. Mm. I mean, it obviously is a very, very powerful piece of writing, and Baker talks a lot about the African landscape, about pesticides, a whole load. He feels as though he's trying to contextualize it much more widely, particularly in the introduction. But I mean, I would say that I think his ill health probably began to constrain him really significantly at a point where he might have become more of an active writer and campaigner. And I mean, the little essay which is in here, which came in Birds magazine, I mean, he actually writes, we must not let, well, this he's talking about the death of a red-throated diver here, but he says we must not let its death be soothed away by the lullaby language of indifferent politicians, which, I mean, you know, could be written today, basically, about the environment movement and much of the concern that we have. So I think perhaps he felt like an activist and he was finding his voice, and maybe that sort of environmental activist writing wasn't, well, I mean, Carson, but... Mm. It's so commonplace now. We think of Monbiot, we think of all of these people writing in this genre, but it wasn't so common then. Maybe. Mm.
Thank you. So let's lead into the literary placing, if we could, in the sense of whether he saw himself in a lineage, and maybe also the sense of the influence he's had as well.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating question. And when John sent me the library database, which he built out, which is just absolute gold to someone, well, to so many people, I was fascinated to see Ballard there. Mm. Ballard writes this short story, Storm Bird, Storm Dreamer, in the late 60s, which you obviously know, which is about pesticide. It's a fantasy SF, effectively, or futurological story about the effects of pesticide on bird populations. And it imagines that what's happened is that it's caused them to grow to predatory size, all of them, and the whole of East Anglia has been militarized to resist the incursions of these pesticide roided birds that come in to raid the fields of East Anglia. So clearly it's a war dream in some way, but it's also a very, very contemporary response. I think it's published in 67 as well, to the pesticide crisis. So in an odd way, I mean, we can pick an easy lineage for him, which involves Hopkins, and it involves Hughes. But I'm more interested in the one that involves Ballard and those other rather more unexpected outliers. I suppose the other thing I'd say, a self-conscious sense of a nature writing tradition, which we have problematically and virtuously now, although, as I always say, I'd quite like to just cut the adjective because and just call them writers. I don't think it was there then, particularly in terms of prose. And in many ways, he's a poet. He's got more in common with HD, he's got more in common with imagism, objectivism, than he does with the kinds of sort of Francis Gilbert, Gilbert White style country parson prose that we might associate with that stronger nature writing tradition as it was bearing on him then. So I think he knows he's trying to do something absolutely different. He doesn't know quite what it is, but he's drawing beads on people like Ballard, and that is one of the things that makes it so weird when we at that moment and still.
If I could just add, if I could just add like a small thing to that, I think he very much his bread and butter, particularly as a younger man in terms of literature, was romantics, and I think he loved he was deeply indebted to the romantic poetry movement, but he also loved a certain number of the modernists. He loved Dylan Thomas, mm-hmm. And the sort of startling lyrical, very evocative musical nature of Dylan Thomas's writing. He thought was very different and wonderful, and I think you find some of the sort of romantic lyricism in his writing for sure. One of the interesting, I mean, the course that I, the wonderful course I took with Rob, was called the Postpastoral, and I think there's definitely an element of Baker seeing himself as coming from this sort of pastoralized romantic literary past inheritance, and the ways it's more interesting the ways in which, in a sort of Ballardian way, he sort of destroys bits of that or turns them over and changes them into something very different and more startling. And sort of, yeah, post-pastoral.
Thank you. And if we could answer, if we can, or at least attempt to answer the mothership question, is it about Baker, is it about Peregrine? And then if you could lead into your closing reading, Hetty, that would be great.
Yeah. I feel a bit bad, really, because after all of this, I feel like this is not something that Baker would really have necessarily wanted or appreciated. In terms of him being a private person.
Do you mean all of this?
Possibly, yeah, I mean this. But he very much saw himself, he wanted to be a great writer. That's what he wanted more than anything. But it wasn't, he didn't necessarily want to be a great celebrity. It wasn't about him. The book, certainly, he erases himself from so much of the writing in many ways, but is also very insistent on the subjective experience of the watcher being an important aspect of bird watching. So the feelings and the emotions. Actually, something that didn't make it into the a line from his from a draft introduction that he had said something like, I'm going to forget what it is now. Something like science is not the only thing. The emotions are also important. In terms of ecology, he was very insistent that the feelings were an important aspect. Also to campaigning as well. I think he understood that people aren't necessarily passionate about science in its purest form. They don't become passionate about those things quite so much as they become passionate about things they feel very strongly about in an emotional sense. So it's not really about the book itself. The Peregrine is less about Baker and more about the Peregrine. It's a short answer to that question, really.
Would you like to give us a closing reading?
I just wanted to sort of, I was thinking about how to finish this, and maybe finish actually in something that combines all of those questions in one, maybe the idea of the campaigning and his literary inheritance and how he felt himself fitting into the landscape of writing. So he loved Ted Hughes, and this is just a little bit from Ted Hughes, The Hawk in the Rain, then just a little bit about Baker's feeling on that poem. Strain towards the master fulcrum of violence where the hawk hangs still, that maybe in his own time meets the weather coming the wrong way. Hughes' poem, The Hawk in the Rain, was one of Baker's favourites. He left a number of subtle references to it in the Peregrine, scribbled quotations from the poem among his notes. In particular, Hughes' lines on the hawk as the diamond point of will that polestars the sea drowner's endurance were ones that seemed to have resonated with Baker. Struggling against the pain of his illness as he crossed the salt marshes in search of peregrines, Baker must have felt both a deep connection and envy of the raptor flying without effort in the skies above. He was one and the same with the narrator of Hughes' poem, the hawk hunter who drags heel after heel through the ploughland's clutching clay, suspended forever in pursuit of the bird. The hawks had become Baker's own pole star. They were at the centre of everything that he wrote. Perhaps he saw them as a lifeline, anchors for his creativity and ambition, but also for knowing his place in the world, in the landscape of his beloved Essex, and himself as a writer. Baker wrote that as a child he had been struck by the abiding feeling that he belonged, quote, out there on the edge of things. This feeling pursued him into adulthood. Out there had been a hazy approximation of the distant horizon beyond Chelmsford suburbs, past hedgerows of elm and through farmers' fields into the no man's lands of woods and desolate saltings. But being out there at the edge of things seems to have been the story of the rest of Baker's life too.
Thank you. So what have we learned tonight? We've learned many things, of course. We've learned, first of all, that we need someone with key information in the audience from the very beginning. This is the LRB shop equivalent of phone a friend, where we can get hetero decimation, sadly, but we can get the facts when we need them. Thank you so much for that. We've also learned, of course, that there are many pressures on students, of course, on student debt, on student places, kind of the whole idea of being a student. But now there's a new pressure added, which is the one to produce a major biography within 2 years of taking a course. So that is added to anyone who is a student in the room at the moment. A very positive outcome, of course, in this case. This is a book, I think we should say, of Sibbaldian focus and concentration. There are moments of extraordinary Sibbaldian intensity where a V1 missile dropping over a suburb is compared directly and with great validation to the fall of a peregrine. This is a book that absolutely demands to be on the shelf for numerous reasons on many shelves in the way that W.G. Sebald himself wanted to be. This is a book that has prompted the question, what would a peregrine falcon sound like if it was voiced by Werner Herzog, of course, which we now know it will never be. And yet, in an incredible circularity, we can hear the voice of Werner Herzog as a plastic bag to give us the counterpoint to this wonderful celebration of the ecology, because he has exactly done that. If you go online and Google Werner Herzog plastic bag, you can find a 17-minute film in which Werner Herzog takes us through the life and very, very long death of a plastic bag made by the extraordinary Iranian-American filmmaker Raman Barani. I jest not. So do please find that, because it gives us a sense of Herzog's own melancholy anger about what else we do to the planet apart from celebrate it in the way that this book and this life and work does. I would say at this point, form an orderly queue to get the extraordinary triptych of signatures that you're able to do now, because all three of our wonderful guests have written in this volume. But of course, given the work we're talking about, I think at least one of you should make a voracious dive into that queue and seize the signatures ahead of any kind of permission, of course, at a certain point in the queuing process. I leave that up to you to decide on as you will as to who might be that person, both the Baker Peregrine audience member grabbing the signing literally by its throat. But apart from that, of course, you will all be doing that. And at that point, you can give to our wonderful guests the titles of the books you would like to see reclaimed and restored to the great pantheon. I've noticed that Robert's already written down the red start. So that's already a start, shall we say. In fact, a very red start to the list that we're about to compile. But before we do all of that, of course, please do join me in thanking, first of all, Cressida, Charlie and David tonight, the London Review Bookshop staff. Yourselves are coming, the Kickstarter funders, for making it all possible. Little Toller, giants among publishers. But please now particularly do thank John Fanshawe, Robert McFarlane and Hetty Saunders. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.